Hello there. Today is Friday, October the 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the impeachment inquiry may have just gotten more intense.
And I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy.
Turkey agrees to a brief pause in its attacks in Syria, but what happens after that? Also ahead, a popular indie rocker speaks out about animal rights. It's all on today's International Edition. The White House on Thursday confirmed that President Trump ordered diplomats to work with his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, to get Ukraine to open investigations that would help Trump politically and link them to military aid to Ukraine. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney told reporters that Trump's concerns over the role Ukraine might have played in the 2016 U.S. election to help Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton against Trump were at the heart of his request for the investigations in the Eastern European country.
Did he also mention to me in the past that the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money.
But Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff said Mulvaney's statements pretty much are equal to a confession.
With his acknowledgement now that military aid to a vital ally, an ally battling Russia, as we speak, was withheld in part out of a desire by the president to have Ukraine investigate the DNC server or Democrats or 2016. Things have just gone from very, very bad to much, much worse.
Joining us now to sort out these latest developments is former Central Intelligence Officer, current criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice. Jack, what's your reaction to the statements by the president's chief of staff?
It was astounding to watch, to see a White House chief of staff admit to a quid pro quo. That's what we saw here when Mick Mulvaney came out and said, well, yeah, of course we stopped the money because we wanted to see them investigate. And you watch this and you think this is exactly what the Democrats were digging for, and it just rolled out in front of them.
Explain quid pro quo for people who may not understand what that means.
The real concept is, if I do something for you, you do something for me. In this particular case, the idea was that what the president was doing was holding on to $390 million in military aid for Ukraine, which Ukraine desperately needed. And in return for that $390 million that he would release, the Ukrainians would investigate Joe Biden and Hunter Biden on behalf of the president, hence do me a favor. So when you actually get a sitting chief of staff acknowledging and admitting that, it's a crime for the president to call a foreign power and ask for a favor to go after his own political rival, regardless of whether or not the president actually benefits from it, regardless of whether or not you're actually holding something up, regardless of the quid pro quo. But when you actually add the quid pro quo to it, what it really does is it highlights the selfishness and the self-interest of a sitting president who's actually strong-arming a foreign power, not for the benefit of the U.S., but for the benefit of that sitting president. This is something that presidents of the United States do not, nor should they ever do.
Mulvaney said it happens all the time. It's just politics. There's always politics involved.
No, he's incorrect. This is not something that we do. We do things where we're trying to make sure that countries are doing appropriate things so it benefits the United States of America. That's different. In this particular case, investigating Joe Biden has nothing to do with benefiting the United States. It has everything to do with benefiting a sitting president who may be facing him in the next presidential election. It has nothing to do with the United States. That's not something that's acceptable in this country.
Well, I was going to ask initially if maybe Mulvaney did this on purpose to sort of get it out in the open, making it seem less like he's trying to hide something and just act, you know, trying to normalize it. But now it appears he's walking it back now after getting grief from the White House.
Well, if we look at some of the strategy that we've seen from this White House in the past, in fact, they do that regularly. They will actually come out publicly with unusual behavior, extraordinary things that we would never see and have never seen from previous presidents, almost to normalize it. And in fact, it's that idea that inappropriate and over-the-top behavior is okay, acceptable. The problem is it's not, but this was a little bit different because this was literally an atomic bomb that went off. Because when you heard it, what you realized was that they're admitting not just to trying to get the president to get a foreign power to do something, but doing it specifically so it would benefit the president himself, personally. And that's a different game. It's a different animal entirely.
The president and his allies have repeatedly said that this was just concern about corruption.
The problem in this particular case is if you look at the timing, you look at the behavior, you look at a combination of Rick Perry, who again is just preparing to resign as energy secretary, along with Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, and a Rudy Giuliani, and those three side by side driving into this, not because they're digging into corruption, but because they're digging into Joe Biden. It's a completely and utterly different story.
Well, you mentioned Ambassador Sondland. He's not a career professional like some of these people that have come forward. He was pretty much a donor to the president's campaign, and he sounds like he was a major part of this whole effort to get the Ukrainians to dig up dirt on Joe Biden and the Democratic National Committee. He testified on Capitol Hill Thursday and sounds like he wasn't towing the line for the president.
The White House said very recently that they wouldn't cooperate at all and they wouldn't allow essentially anybody to speak. And yet what we have seen is individual after individual after individual, some of them close to the president, like again the ambassador to the EU, but others like the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State, and a whole series of other individuals have continued to come forward. And what we're seeing is a chipping away, a peeling away of exactly what was going on in Ukraine. And at least at this point, what it appears to be is that Giuliani, alongside others, some of whom have actually been indicted, alongside U.S. Ambassador to the EU and others, were digging and pushing the Ukrainians to go out and dig up dirt for the president to use against Joe Biden in an upcoming campaign. But there is no way to shine this up. There is no way to say that this is something that a president do or that the United States does, because they've never done that. And they would never, under these circumstances or any circumstances, act in this manner. That's simply not what the United States does. And also, it's a violation of campaign finance laws.
Where do you see all this going? I mean, it just seems like this has been an extraordinary week with events evolving rapidly.
I don't think we're done. I think there's a lot more people who are career people who've been involved in Russia, Ukraine, and Europe, who've watched this president actually hijack the diplomatic corps and try to go around everybody else to get what it was that he wants. And I think there will come a time here, and it's coming up very quickly, that there will be more and more people who show up, and they're going to speak up.
All right. Central Intelligence Officer, current criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A Trump property has been picked by Trump as the site for next year's G7 summit with foreign leaders. ISIS families are calling for an uprising in the wake of the Turkish military operations in Syria. China says it's released a detained U.S. student, and how innovators are now cleaning up the world's most polluted capital. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has announced a ceasefire in Turkey's assault on Kurdish fighters in northern Syria following talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Ankara. Pence, accompanied by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and White House National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, met with the Turkish leader. The meeting came a day after President Donald Trump dismissed the importance of the outcome of the fighting, saying it has nothing to do with us. Cindy Sain has the latest.
The Turkish military assault on Kurds in northern Syria, launched after a conversation between U.S. President Donald Trump and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has been widely condemned by members of Congress in the United States and by other leaders across the world. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo headed to Turkey Thursday to push Erdogan to stop the attacks. After hours of talks, Pence made this announcement.
And today, I'm proud to report, thanks to the strong leadership of President Donald Trump and the strong relationship between President Erdogan and Turkey and the United States of America, that today the United States and Turkey have agreed to a ceasefire in Syria.
Pence said that Turkey has agreed to pause its assault for 5 days, while the U.S. facilitates the withdrawal of Kurdish fighters from a large swath of territory that stretched from Turkey's border nearly 32 kilometers into Syria. He said this would save countless lives. But Republican Senator Mitt Romney condemned the deal on the Senate floor, saying it formalizes the U.S. abandoning its Kurdish allies who helped to defeat Islamic State terrorists.
Was there no chance for diplomacy? Are we so weak and so inept diplomatically that Turkey forced the hand of the United States of America? Turkey?
The former U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for the Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Brett McGurk, resigned in protest last December over Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria. He took to Twitter to reject Thursday's deal as a betrayal of the Kurds and as non-implementable. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
And now for our analysis on what has been happening in Syria and the latest developments with this temporary ceasefire. We're joined by Dr. Bill Parker. He's the CEO of the East-West Institute, which works on conflict resolution issues. Thank you for being with us, sir. What is your reaction to the latest developments of this brief ceasefire or pause in fighting?
There was a strong idea on both sides that something positive would come out of this. They were talking privately behind closed doors. Forget all of the public things that you saw out there. Out of that, what you get is it depends on which side you're talking to, of whether it is a ceasefire or whether it's something less than that, like a pause. And the reason it would be a pause vice a ceasefire is because for it to be a ceasefire, both sides would need to recognize the other as an actual nation or as an actual organization that they're willing to recognize. So they're calling it a pause. That's fine. The reality out of all this is that you have 120 hours, 5 days through the 22nd of October. But the reality is that combat operations on the ground appear as if they will stop for the next 5 days.
Is it safe to assume that part of that will be to get U.S. forces that have been told not to contribute anymore to supporting the Kurds, to get them out of harm's way, and also possibly to allow the Kurds to themselves get out of harm's way?
Certainly, the U.S. troops are redeploying or leaving that area. And when they leave the area, it can't be an instant, well, it could be, but normally it's not an instantaneous move because you want to make sure that your classified materials and your weapons, et cetera, are taken with you so that they can't be used against you in the future. But the bigger part, as you point out, is that YPG forces would withdraw to below that 30-kilometer safe zone. And that really is a big part of what is happening here. And there's some agreements in that removal of the YPG, one of which is that they would be protected or not be attacked during that time. Second, that the YPG would leave heavy weapons behind, and they would also make sure that those fortifications were destroyed if necessary. And then also the Turkey and the U.S. would cooperate against ISIS moving forward. So those are kind of the big of the 13 points that came out of the ceasefire or pause, depending on which side you talk to.
And what about this bombing of a weapons facility of the United States that's in Turkey that there was some concern that they could get their hands on?
So there's two different discussions there, one of which is there was a large weapons cache throughout Syria and particularly close to the border so that our forces had ammunition ordnance that they could use to fight. And so if you're leaving in a hurry, you want to make sure that that is not left behind for somebody else to use. So you would go in and destroy that. And that was done. The second conversation that's being had is whether or not there are nuclear weapons on Incirlik Air Base. And if there are, how you would remove those properly if that needed to happen, or if you still considered Turkey to be a solid NATO ally, and therefore you would leave those in place if they're there in the first place.
So what happens when the ceasefire is over?
So when the ceasefire is over is really the big one. The sanctions that are already announced by the U.S. would not be imposed during the five-day period, first of all, and no new sanctions would be introduced. And after the operation stops, those sanctions would be lifted. So that's one part of it. Secondly, Turkey would maintain control of the safe zone. It would not leave its positions, and it will monitor YPG as it continues to withdraw and should actually be withdrawn after those 5 days. And then the U.S. and the Syrian Defense Force, SDF, would cooperate outside of the safe zone in other operations. So it's not like the U.S. is not operating at all with SDF in the future. The U.S. would agree to Turkey's demands of that 30-kilometer deep safe zone in North Syria. And Turkey would present this domestically probably as a win, because they're saying that at least for the first part that they have been able to do their operation, and now YPG is moving out of that area and they have the safe zone. On the other side, the U.S. is able to get the ceasefire to be established. And so at least in the short term, there's no more casualties happening during that period of time, because there were 200 to 300 casualties, depending on which numbers you look at, during that this period of operations. And certainly a lot of fierce fighting in the last 2 days.
What about the ISIS fighters that are being released or escaping? What happens now?
There is a major effort underway to grab those guys back up as quickly as possible, because that is a major threat. You don't want those folks, especially really bad ones, running around out there. Not that there's such a thing as a good ISIS fighter, but certainly we don't want them running around. So I know there is a major effort underway to recover them.
All right, that's Dr. Bill Parker. He's the CEO of the East-West Institute. The European Union has reacted with skepticism to new proposals from Britain for a deal to leave the bloc. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson outlined the plans Tuesday, which aimed to break the impasse over the future of the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which becomes an external EU frontier after Brexit. Britain is due to leave the EU at the end of the month, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
In Brussels, negotiations usually go late into the night, so there was palpable shock as Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker took to the podium Thursday afternoon.
We have a deal. And this deal means that there was no need for any kind of prolongation.
So, a Brexit breakthrough for British Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
I do think that this deal represents a very good deal both for the EU and for the UK.
Johnson's pledge to leave the EU do or die on the October 31st deadline may yet fail, as it has to be approved in the British and European parliaments. British MPs will sit in session Saturday for the first time since 1982. The agreement was sealed thanks to changes to the Northern Irish backstop clause. The new deal envisages Northern Ireland remaining in the United Kingdom's custom territory, but in practice it will follow EU rules with an effective customs border down the Irish Sea. That avoids border checks on Northern Ireland, but the Democratic Unionist Party has rejected any deal that treats Northern Ireland differently to the rest of the United Kingdom.
We believe it is not in the interests of Northern Ireland, either economically, and I've explained all of that around a border essentially for not just regulations but for goods. We have different VAT rules and we have no effective consent over any of those rules.
Democratic Unionist MPs are crucial if Boris Johnson is to get the deal through Parliament. All opposition parties in Britain have indicated they will vote against it. Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker warned the EU would not grant any further Brexit extensions, turning up the heat on British lawmakers.
As long as they believe that there's some sort of third option, so a second referendum, another extension, a general election, some sort of better deal, whatever it is, they do not seem to be willing to vote for the deal that is on the table.
The speed of agreement in Brussels shows how keen the EU is to move ahead with a smooth Brexit. But there could be plenty more hurdles ahead as Boris Johnson returns to Britain, ready for what's billed as Super Saturday in Parliament. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Brussels.
Democratic U.S. Representative Elijah Cummings, a powerful and respected voice in Washington, passed away Thursday at the age of 68.
Cummings was one of the heads of an impeachment committee investigating President Donald Trump. The late U.S. congressman who represented the state of Maryland was also an inspirational figure for many, especially African Americans. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill.
Washington in mourning for the loss of one of its most powerful voices.
When we're dancing with the angels, the question will be asked, in 2019, what did we do to make sure we kept our democracy intact?
Head of the House Oversight Committee leading the impeachment inquiry into Trump, Cummings had a fierce sense of justice that still drew respect from fellow Republicans. President Trump tweeted his condolences, but earlier this summer, he had harsh words for Cummings and his predominantly African-American home city of Baltimore.
Those people are living in hell in Baltimore.
The president's claim Cummings' district was a rat and rodent-infested mess, seen as a racially insensitive attack, looked at as retaliation for Cummings' investigations into the administration.
We are the United States of America. We are the greatest country in the world. We are the ones that can go anywhere in the world and save people.
But both Democrats and Republicans remembered him Thursday as one of the leading figures in Congress for his strong values.
Concerned about voting rights, civil rights, alleviating poverty, establishing justice, and ensuring that those entrusted with high office are held accountable and carry out their responsibilities lawfully and ethically.
Cummings began life the son of sharecroppers, becoming a civil rights activist in the 1960s before rising through hard work and political skill to become a key voice in Congress after serving for years in the state of Maryland General Assembly.
He lived the American dream, and he wanted it for everyone else.
A legacy his congressional colleagues said they would carry on in his memory. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And you're listening to International Edition, back in a minute.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. Every October for the past 48 years, hot air balloons have been flying the skies over Albuquerque, New Mexico, giving spectators both on and off the ground a visual feast of rare beauty. VOA's Julie Tabot visited the southwestern state's largest city to see how a modest launch of 13 balloons almost five decades ago has evolved into the largest ballooning event in the world.
Morning. How you doing?
Gary Miklik has been piloting hot air balloons for 32 years.
Slowing down a little bit.
20 of those years have been at the Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta, where these aerial marvels have been filling the skies over New Mexico for the past 48 years.
We're just flying above the surface of the earth, like, you know, really, you know, close to the ground or high up. I mean, it's unique. You have few types of aviation where you can just float above the ground. So yeah, after that first like, it's like, you're hooked.
The festival is the largest ballooning event in the world. This year, it drew more than 550 pilots from across the U.S. and from 17 other countries. About 800,000 visitors came to see balloons of all shapes and sizes. From special Glodio events at night, to the early morning mass ascensions. a stunning display of hundreds of balloons that take to the skies at sunrise in a series of waves over the course of an hour.
I've been coming out for 40 years since I came out here for college, and it's fabulous every single time. You can't beat it.
It screams New Mexico. I don't know another place that has something remotely close to this.
It's almost like a tradition to come every year and meet it, so every New Mexican knows that every time when October comes, it's the balloon time.
I've never seen this in real life, and that made me think, what if I was here in New Mexico one day and my cousins took me over here and my dream actually came true?
The balloons are located in a massive launch field where the crowds can get up close. And that makes it more personal, says Operations Director Sam Parks.
One of the things that I heard yesterday, which really touched my heart, was a young boy telling his mother, "This is the best day ever." And so when you hear things like that, it just kind of puts it all in perspective, and it makes you feel like you're doing a good thing.
That's a familiar feeling for regulars like Miklik. And something to aspire to for those still dreaming to come.
So this is at a bucket list for every balloonist all over the world. They have to come here. And some keep coming back, like me.
See you next year.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Indie singer Billie Eilish used her platform to take a stand on a cause she believes in. She's calling out people who wear mink fur and eyelashes. She's known for being very sweet and soft-spoken during her concerts and meetups with fans, but clearly this issue matters to her. So Billie, who is an animal rights activist and has a love for animals, says it's one of the main reasons why she's vegan. She's previously called out people who eat meat. Eilish posted a series of photos of minks on Instagram with captions slamming people who wear fur and asking, "Where is your heart?" The posts were later deleted. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
I like it when you take control, even if you know that you don't own me. To play the role, I'll be your animal. My mommy likes to sing along with me, but she won't sing this song if she reads her belly. We still pity the men I know. So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy, just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type, make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy. Duh. I'm wearing your cologne.
This is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.